This is oral history interview number 16 on May 16, 1975 with Dr. Beckert Haworth, a member of the Washington University School of Medicine, class of 1925. Dr. Haworth, tell us of your family and of your early childhood.
I was born in West Point, Mississippi, and that's the northeastern part of the state. And my father was a businessman in town after having been a banker for a few years. My mother had been a school teacher before she was married. And my father's father was a businessman, and my great-grandfather was a physician, but I never knew him. My mother's father and her brothers became lawyers, and my mother had been interested in my becoming a lawyer. My father wanted me to be a businessman, so they were a little bit disappointed when I went into medicine, particularly since we had no real family background for that. Of course, as one goes back, ancestors multiply rapidly if the women are included, which sometimes are left out. But the Becketts in my family, which was my mother's family name, came from the north of Ireland. The Beckett who came over married a Kyle, K-Y-L-E. And my father's family had migrated from South Carolina. One branch of them actually were in the French Huguenot group who came to Carolina in the early days. And on my father's side was a Marion, came from France, and General Francis Marion was of this family, one of Washington's generals during the Revolutionary War. But of course, that was many generations before. The early childhood was in our own home, and I remember very little about the time, excuse me, before I went to school. My aunt was in charge of the primary school, and although that was on the other side of town, my family wished me to be in her grade the first year, so I walked 2 miles across town in order to go to school and to be in her class in that early period. Later I went to the school near our home, and in the first 7 years, it was decided that I should move up a grade, so they skipped me one grade in order to get me into a more advanced class, since we didn't have any division in our classes at that time. This saved a year and was an advantage later. In high school, I remember being the most frightened student when it became necessary to recite, and I would almost shake when I had to stand up and recite. I realized that this was a handicap later and tried to overcome it. During high school, my interests were toward mechanical things, and I can recall building a lathe from an old sewing machine. And although it was foot pedal rather than motor pedal, it was effective. I did play tennis, but didn't engage in any formal sports during that period. Partly because in the afternoons after school and on Saturday, I worked in my father's store. And at other times, I worked in our garden and raked leaves, things of that sort. So I was rather busy with various activities around the home and at the store, and didn't really have much time to play.
Where did you have your college education?
I went to the University of Mississippi at Oxford and had my academic work there. I liked school, I liked my subjects, and it didn't seem too difficult for me, so I persuaded them to let me take extra courses. And as a result of this, in 3 years, I was able to obtain my Bachelor of Science degree, cum laude. But during that time, as electives, I had taken engineering because I had been somewhat interested in engineering and wasn't then particularly interested in medicine. This was good because civil engineering not only served as an opportunity to earn money in the summer to help pay my college expenses, but also it good background for the mechanics of orthopedics later. I did some photography in school, and this too helped pay my expenses. This was mainly in connection with the college activities, such as football.
Dr. Haworth, what were your extracurricular activities in college?
In addition to those mentioned, I belonged to the Literary Society, which actually was largely run by the lawyers, and this for them was a training place for learning to debate and learning Robert's Rules of Order. I did learn Robert's Rules of Order, and this stood me in good stead, particularly when later I became secretary of a medical organization. And I also became editor of the yearbook for my class, and the following year was was business manager for the yearbook, something which I think was probably unique. So I wasn't just a bookworm, I had various activities, including myself being on the football squad and on the track squad.
How did you decide to enter medicine?
During this academic period at the University of Mississippi, I wrestled with the idea of which direction to go, first leaning toward engineering, but being a little discouraged by the situation of engineering at that time, I leaned gradually toward medicine. And in order to prepare the way, I did take the pre-medical physics and chemistry instead of the regular courses, so that I didn't lose any time. And when I did finally decide to go into medicine, it was the background was already completed, and I could go directly into medicine. At that time in Mississippi, particularly in my hometown, we had general practitioners, general surgeons, and eye and nose and throat specialists, and that was about it. I had never even heard of orthopedics and had no idea what it was.
What was your medical education?
I had the first 2 years at the University of Mississippi, during which, against advice, I continued on the football squad and was business manager of the college annual. And we had a very good faculty, and this was a very fine background, but the university at that time had only the first 2 years of medicine, so it was necessary to transfer somewhere else. And I debated whether to go to one of the nearer schools, like Tennessee or Tulane or Vanderbilt, but learned that at that time the four top-rating medical schools in the country included Washington University, which was closer than some of the eastern schools. And so I applied for my last 2 years there and was accepted, and thus entered Washington University.
What were your summer activities when you were in medical school?
When I was at the University of Mississippi, during the academic period as well as the first year of medicine, I worked as an engineer on the Mississippi River. Our job was to survey the river and to prepare the way for flood control so that in the next spring the flood wouldn't devastate a lot of the land. This was a rather interesting job, but we can't take time to go into further detail. In my last year, I worked on malaria control work in Shelby County in Tennessee, where Memphis is located, and this was quite interesting. Particularly because my chief was a man, Major LaPrince, who had worked with Goethals and Gorgas in the Panama Canal, and he was very knowing. And I can well remember one remark he said to me after he told me that I had to make the talks to the people in the evening and explain to them how mosquitoes developed and how they got malaria. And he said, "You make the talks, but I have one suggestion. Get them leaning forward in their chairs and then quit."
What did you do just after graduation from Washington University Medical School?
I was interested in the possibility of getting involved with the Boy Scouts, and then that I could have the job of being physician for the St. Louis Council of the Boy Scouts. And that camp was at Irondale, Missouri, in the Ozarks. So that summer I did serve, because I had an interval before my internship started. I I did service camp position. But I found that there were many interesting things going on, and I thought, as I always have, that it would be interesting to learn as well as to teach. So I was given the job of teaching first aid and public health and so forth for the merit badges courses. But at the same time, I took the senior life-saving training and subsequently obtained the certificate and also began taking merit badges myself. So in the course of the summer, I obtained the 21 merit badges necessary to become an Eagle Scout. This may be something of a record. I suppose hardly anyone has gotten 21 merit badges in 2 months. But I'm very proud of that, and it was a good start in that direction.
Tell us of your internship.
Dr. Graham, who was chief of surgery, had hoped that I would apply for an internship with him, and in thinking of the possibilities, at that time I was not ready to specialize or to lead toward a specialization. It seemed that a surgical preparation might be a better background for general practice or anything else that I might like to do. On the other hand, some of my advisors suggested that having been at Washington University for 2 years, it might be well to go somewhere else and get other ideas and other training. I did apply in New York at Presbyterian Hospital and was asked to come there for an interview, which actually was made after Dr. Graham's appointment, so I had to make a decision and give up any opportunity of continuing at Washington University. I was accepted at Presbyterian, although at that time their 8 surgical interns were usually chosen, 6 from Columbia University and 2 from Harvard. But the ice had been broken a year or so previously by 2 or 3 other men, such as Scott Johnson, who went there as a medical intern, and Ed Saunders and Henry Cooper, who became surgical interns. So Washington University was allowed into the group of internships, and thus I started my 2-year service with Dr. Auchincloss, Hugh Auchincloss as my chief, and Dr. Alan Whipple as the chief of surgery and professor of surgery.
What were your vacation activities?
Well, I continued to have no money. In fact, had to borrow money while I was an intern, and so although we had only 2 weeks of vacation at the beginning, I inquired about the Boy Scout camp in New York State and found that it didn't open in June when my vacation occurred, but was referred to the New York State YMCA. And they welcomed me to their camp at Westport, New York on Lake Champlain. So I spent my first 2 vacations there, helping somewhat as a camp physician. And subsequently, when I had a longer vacation, I was camp doctor for a number of years. And instead of just doing the work of a physician, again, I participated in the program at camp, which included hikes into the Adirondack Mountains. And I asked to be excused now and then and go on one of the hikes as a camp leader. And at that time, did begin walking up in the mountains.
How did you decide to enter orthopedics?
Again, I was wrestling with what direction to go and considered various possibilities. The consultant in orthopedics at the Presbyterian Hospital was Dr. Russell Hibbs, who was a very impressive man. And it happened at that time that 2 of my associate house surgeons did decide to go into orthopedics, so I thought at least I would investigate. Had an interview with Dr. Hibbs, he encouraged me, and I did then decide that I would take a residency with Dr. Hibbs at the New York Orthopedic Hospital, which was the teaching orthopedic department of Columbia University, although it was geographically separate.
What was your orthopedic training?
When I entered training at the orthopedic hospital, it was a 2-year residency service. And that was it, and quite a number of men had been graduated on that program. during the 2 years, although originally I thought 2 years would be a long time, in addition to my surgical internship, a fellowship system was started. I think the first orthopedic fellowship in the United States, perhaps in the world. Dr. Hibbs obtained the money for this because he thought that we needed additional training and that a fellowship would provide it. At first I was hesitant about spending 3 extra years, which the fellowship required, but decided this should be worthwhile, and although I was not the first, I did start in on the fellowship program of 3 years of full-time work. This included work in the clinic, or work on the wards, in the operating room, and Dr. Hibbs also was very foresighted in starting a follow-up clinic. In those days, our major problems and our most common problems were joint tuberculosis and polio. Our third problem was scoliosis, and we did have a country branch where these children went after their surgery. And this was part of our residency training program, and a very important part because we were able to follow the children through their convalescence as well as through their early post-operative period.
Was a doctorate of medical science offered at that time?
We didn't have the specialty boards, and there was an effort to qualify men beyond that of such things as the American College of Surgeons and the licensing which everyone had. And it was thought that for the specialties, if there were a sort of super degree in medical skills comparable to the PhD or the Doctor of Philosophy, that this would serve the purpose. So the Doctor of Medical Science was created, M-E-D-S-C-D, and several of us at that time went through this program. It required an oral examination and a thesis, very much as was done for the PhD, and I did take this and received this degree. A year or two later, the boards were instituted, and the degree, I believe, was continued, but hardly ever did anyone attempt to do it, because the boards really took the place of it. So I think the medical science degree is hardly known today.
What were your outside activities at that time?
Not very much time for outside activities, because we had a very long in-service program. But my vacation activities were largely connected with mountaineering, and I started going west to Wyoming after having been trained in the east in rock climbing by a group in the Appalachian Mountain Club. I joined the club because of its interest in outdoor activities, which was a good antidote for working inside a hospital in a big city like New York. And the club had such activities as Sunday and Saturday afternoon hikes and various other things like camping and canoeing and snowshoeing at that time, although later skiing took precedence, and mountain climbing. And having been thoroughly trained in New York in the technique of rock climbing, and having spent one vacation period in Maine at Mount Katahdin, then one of these summers I did go to Wyoming in the early 30s to the Wind River Mountains and the Tetons with the Appalachian Mountain Club. Having been so well trained, it was possible to do some fairly difficult ascents, and I met my principal teacher, Fritz Wiesner, who had been in Germany before the war but naturalized American and a very great mountaineer. And he came down from a trip to Alaska, and with two others, the four of us made the second ascent of the North Ridge of the Grand Teton, which in those days was considered a very tough rock climb. We did quite another number of other ascents too, not only that summer, but in various other summers. In the club, there were trips on what we called white water, which was through the rapids. And we would run the rapids on the Delaware River, the Housatonic River in Connecticut, and the 10 Mile River. My wife, when we first knew each other, was not very active in outdoor things, and couldn't swim, and couldn't ski, and couldn't climb. But she soon learned to do these things, and we were able to do them together. And after she learned to swim, I was willing to take her along on these whitewater canoe trips in the rapids. At about this time, I got interested in skiing, which also was one of the Appalachian Club activities. But in those days, there were no ski lifts. We had to walk up the mountains. Therefore, there weren't very many of us, and the trails weren't crowded. And actually, the trails weren't nearly as well developed as they have been since. The technique of skiing was, compared with today's standards, somewhat primitive but effective, and it was possible to come down these mountain trails safely. None of us ever got hurt because we were in good condition, we knew what we were doing, we were very conscious of staying within our abilities, and so this was no great problem. And these then were the principal outside activities during this early period of orthopedics in New York.
How did you begin your investigative work?
Dr. Hibbs came to me one day in my early fellowship period, and he said, "I'd like you to study the congenital hips. This is congenital displacement of the hip, and which occurs in so many infants at birth." This was all he said, but we did have typed records. We had saved all of the x-rays, even the old glass plates, in the files of the hospital. And so we had access to all of the material which had gone before. And my study consisted of analyzing these records and what had been done and what the results were. And of course the follow-up clinic gave us a continuing study of how these patients fared after their surgery or after their treatment. Furthermore, I was assigned to examining each patient on admission before surgery, to participating in some way in the surgery itself, and to following the patient afterwards. So I had a rather complete personal approach to the study of this problem. After some months, Dr. Hibbs came to me and said he'd like me to study the slipping capsule femoral epiphysis. So I was assigned that job. And we did have a relatively large number of cases of both these conditions. So the studies were fascinating and very productive, and that we not only learned what had gone before, but also we learned what to do in the future to improve the quality of care of these patients and improve the quality of surgery. So these two subjects have become two of my lifelong interests in orthopedics. Dr. Hibbs didn't suggest it, but during this time I became interested in body mechanics and the way people used their bodies, although the primary emphasis at the orthopedic hospital, because of the great need, was on surgery. And after working along these lines, using my background of engineering, of orthopedics, of sports, such as football and track and mountaineering and skiing, I put together a set of principles which I call dynamic posture, or posture in action. And my first paper on this subject was published in the Journal of the AMA in 1946. This brought out the difference between static posture, which Dr. Goldthwait in Boston had been so active in promoting. This was particularly in relation to sitting and standing erect, and my concern was how people use their bodies in action, and that really was what dynamic posture meant. And so I began teaching people, patients particularly, but others too, the best and most efficient use and the safest use of the human body in action. And this concept has continued, so that now I've had 30 years experience with it, with many thousands of patients. Also, I've taught various people skiing and taught many people mountaineering in connection with the Appalachian Club particularly, so that dynamic posture has been something that has been very close to me and actually has not been very widely used by others, principally because it takes a great deal of time and effort and training to understand its principles and to apply them, and it takes a great deal of time with patience, so that it isn't really remunerative, but it's, to me, satisfying, and it's the way I like to do it. When I've been asked to speak in other places and given them a choice of subject, very often dynamic posture has been the first choice, so that this subject now is fairly well known in other countries and even in other continents. These three, then, were my principal interests, but I began to think in terms of writing a textbook, and one of the publishers, Saunders, came to me and in fact requested that I write a book for nurses, a handbook of orthopedics. I went to work on this but had the idea that maybe it would be good if I wrote a better book than they requested, and one that could be used not only by nurses but by physicians. They subsequently informed me that this was not possible, that a book had to be directed toward only one audience, and they thought that the work looked satisfactory and that I should rework it and develop it in terms of a medical student audience and write a book of that sort. This, of course, took a lot of extra time and effort, and in the meantime, having worked on these various hip subjects and others, I'd been accumulating not only knowledge but also illustrations, so that when it became time to select illustrations for the textbook, I had a background of a great many to choose from, both in the hospital and those which I developed myself. Actually, the book took 7 years to produce, and this meant every evening and every Sunday and every holiday, so that my wife began to say, when am I going to see something besides your back? But a lot of this was not anticipated, such as the change from a nursing book to the other book, and this is one reason why it took that long. Certainly, there isn't much temptation today for anyone to write such a book, because it does take a greater time, and it is very demanding, and therefore the tendency now is for someone to become an editor and have various men write individual chapters. During this time, I also wrote a number of papers, not only on congenital displacement of the hip, but also on slipping capsulopyphthis and coxiplanar and several other subjects. And altogether, while I was working in New York, this amounted to about 25 papers. I was asked, too, to write for Consumers Research, because this was a then new organization, the first of its kind, and the director and I knew each other, and they needed help in relation to their medical articles, and so I wrote a number of articles for them during this early period, and occasionally I wrote articles for nursing journals and also for the mountaineering journals such as Appalachia and the Journal of the American Alpine Club. Some of these were related to the body mechanics of climbing, and some of the mountaineering articles were simply descriptions of our adventures in these various trips to Wyoming and elsewhere.
Tell us of your early teaching.
One day Dr. Hibbs came in to me, as he had with the writing, the investigation, and he said, you have the students tomorrow. And I said, what do I do? He said, that's for you to find out. You have them for 2 hours just after lunch. I had them, And after a bit, they went to sleep, some of them. And I decided this was my fault, that I should learn how to teach. And that's the last time a student has ever gone to sleep in my class. So we had a group from Columbia Presbyterian who came for their orthopedic teaching, and we did have a fairly adequate time teaching program. The beginning, which I speak of, was basically practical, in that they came into the clinic and we taught them how to examine patients and evaluate them and discuss the various possibilities as to treatment. There was also a lecture program, which usually was done by Dr. Hibbs and those closest to him. But we had a third course, and that was in practical orthopedic anatomy. This was elective, and I was assigned part of it. And it occurred to me that instead of merely repeating the first year dissection, I should really teach them living human anatomy. So I would have the students remove their shoes and socks, or roll up their trousers, or even come dressed in shorts or bathing suits, and examine each other first before we went into the dissecting room. And this way we learned living human anatomy. Actually, I'd gotten this idea because I'd been given the job of teaching postgraduate nurses at Teachers College, which is connected with Columbia University. And we had no cadavers, and hardly any models of any sort, just our textbooks and diagrams, and I realized that the nurses weren't going to learn very much anatomy like this. So I advised them to come in bathing suits and to pair off and to learn anatomy on each other, which they did, and they became very good at living anatomy. It seemed to me this was a good way for the students, and it turned out to be so. In fact, our course became so popular as an elective that the other departments wanted to participate. And so they forced us to share the course with departments such as medicine and surgery and obstetrics and so forth. During this time, because of my work on congenital hips, I was interested in the anatomy of the fetal hip and was able, through the Department of OB Pathology, to get some specimens of stillborns, both at about term and as early as the 10th fetal week. And these I dissected and studied, and not only did they give me a knowledge of the anatomy of the infant hip, but also they were great help in improving surgery on these very young and relatively delicate hips as compared with the adult hips and the older children that we've been operating upon for such things as tuberculosis of the hip. This was the first such study, I believe, in the world, and it was reported and was a considerable help in those ways. This was my chief laboratory investigative work because most of it was clinical.
Did you do writing in those days?
The principle which Dr. Hibb set up for the staff was that each fellow, in addition to the attendings, with whom it was voluntary, each fellow would be expected to write at least one paper while he was at the orthopedic hospital. He was asked to present this at a staff meeting where it was constructively criticized, and if it seemed worthwhile, it was offered to the New York Academy of Medicine for one of their programs, and most of these papers, by all of us, were accepted for such programs. If it seemed still better, it was offered for presentation at one of the national meetings. And as a result of this, actually all of the papers that I wrote did get presented at national meetings and did get published in various journals, such as that of the AMA and the Journal of the American College of Surgeons, and also the then only Journal of Orthopedics, the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery. Some years later, the Journal of Clinical Orthopedics was founded, and so some of my articles. Usually in connection with meetings which I attended, there was a request to submit a written publication. And so some of these found their way into such journals as the Journal of the Western Pacific Orthopedic Association and the Journal called Acta Ortopedica Scandinavica. But this was in a subsequent period, and I'm really moving a little bit ahead in answering the question about my writing. So that in these early days, I would work along several lines. First, do the investigation in order to learn what I could and to apply it to the practice of orthopedics at the orthopedic hospital and in my private practice, which had begun to develop at that time. Second, to use this as teaching material for the students. And third, to use it as writing material for publication and for presentation at these various national and subsequently international meetings.
After completing of your training, what were your connections and activities?
Well, I remained on the staff at the New York Orthopedic Hospital as one of the attending surgeons. I did have 1 year of special experience as an attending on the fracture service at Columbia Presbyterian, because at that time a physical union between the two institutions was contemplated. I was also consultant in orthopedics at the Roosevelt Hospital in New York and attended clinics in the hospital twice a week. I was consultant at the Vanderbilt Clinic of the Medical Center and attended that once a week, and also was consultant at the Babies Hospital, which was part of the Medical Center. Of course, with this, there were the teaching appointments at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons.
Did you continue writing?
Yes, I have always thought that, for me at least, the important parts of medicine and orthopedics were patient care, investigation, which might be clinical or laboratory or both, teaching, which included writing, and thought for the future. Of course, administration is another part, but I was much less interested in this and did not wish to get too involved in administrative work, because committee meetings and things of that sort take so much time away from the other work, which I prefer to do.
Did you write for others than orthopedists?
I mentioned my writing for Consumers Research and for the nursing journals and for the mountaineering journals. These were my principal activities. I did have some programs at the YMCA, for example, in New York at that time, and for other groups occasionally.
Did your wife participate in your activities?
My wife soon became my right-hand man, and although she was not medical trained, she helped with typing, she helped in other ways with the production of the book. She was very much concerned with my life, and since we had no children, she would go with me to the meetings and soon became rather knowledgeable as far as the activities, at least of the ladies of meetings, became very well known among these groups, although in New York this was only the beginning.
Were there any significant changes in your professional and personal life?
Yes, there was a very big change. The move of the New York Orthopedic Hospital to the Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center was delayed for several years, but it was in the offing, and since I was working there too, I realized what this would mean. We had a 160-bed hospital downtown at the New York Orthopedic with 60 private beds for the use of about 10 attendings. When the move to the medical center was contemplated, the number of ward beds was reduced from 100 to about 40, although the fracture service of 20 beds was added to the orthopedic department, and we hadn't had an active fracture service at the New York Orthopedic Hospital. But we completely lost the 60 private beds. There were 200 private beds in the whole medical center, used by 300 doctors. And of those beds, 30 or 40 of them were immediately taken by the chiefs, who were allowed any number of beds, and the rest of us had to compete for the remaining beds. Well, you can see what that meant. There was a waiting list of many weeks to get a patient into the hospital. Even emergencies frequently had to wait for some time unless it were a matter of life and death. So when the move was finally made uptown, the orthopedic hospital was given one floor in the baby's hospital and one wing in the Presbyterian hospital. And this was quite inadequate, and of course the private situation was worse. The loss of time was great. It might take 5 minutes on the average just to get an elevator, and if this happened 12 times a day, there was an hour spent just wasted just waiting for elevators. Waiting for x-rays was equally time wasteful. And I had gone as far as I could in my work in New York, and even though I had excellent connections and a very good private practice, I was spending 30 hours a week working for the institution without pay, and having to try to make a living after that. I was then invited to come to Connecticut. Many of my patients came from Connecticut, and the doctors who sent them would say, "Why don't you come out here? We need you." And actually, there was no orthopedics being done of consequence in southwestern Connecticut at that time. So after interviews in Stamford and Greenwich, I did decide to see what might happen and established an office 2 afternoons a week. This meant considerable driving. It's about 50 miles each way back and forth, and so it was rather difficult in that way. But I was consultant at not only those two hospitals, but Northern Westchester and St. Joseph, so I had an opportunity to see as consultant quite a number of patients for the general practitioners and general surgeons. And not only did it become evident that I would be unable to work in Connecticut and continue working 30 hours a week for the institution in New York, but also that for the good of my patients, I would have to make a choice. I was involved in writing my textbook and in teaching and other commitments, so that it wasn't possible to make a quick change, but I did as rapidly as possible leave New York and gradually discontinue my private practice there, continuing as consultant at Roosevelt Hospital for some time. So the transition period was about 5 years, and it was very difficult, not only because of the commuting, but because of the divided interests. But it soon became evident that Connecticut needed me, that there was plenty of work there for me to do, and that although it was in a sense pioneer work, that I should make this change. And also it meant a change in way of life, because in New York we lived in an apartment in a crowded city, difficult to get about. And although we had many advantages, such as the Philharmonics and the Natural History Program at the Museum and the Metropolitan Museum of Art, all of which we enjoyed, we thought these might still be accessible to us. And to have a home in the country was then quite appealing. So we did finally complete the move in 1949, and I gave up my work in New York entirely at that time. Naturally, it was necessary to resign from the Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center because I couldn't meet the schedule of 30 hours a week. And after that, I was invited to become a member of the staff of the New York University Medical Center with Walter Thompson as my chief. He had been one of our trainees at the New York Orthopedic Hospital. And he said that I would not have to meet any strict schedule, but that whatever teaching I did, wherever I did it, would be sufficient for him and to have me on the staff as a clinical professor. So I have continued in that position, and although I now and then go in and give lectures to his residents, most of my teaching has been outside the city. When I did move to Connecticut, my friends in New York thought it was a very bad move to give up such good connections and all in the city and go, as they called it, into the wilderness. And many people said, "Well, I guess you're retiring or semi-retired." And actually, although it was a strange thing to many of the fellows with whom I worked in Stanford and Greenwich, to teach and to write and to attend meetings, and I did continue all of these things and continued my 60-hour-a-week, 6 days-a-week schedule of patient care. And so moving to Connecticut meant a very radical change in many ways. First, no one was familiar with orthopedic operations, so it was necessary not only for me to train the girls in the operating room and to work out new plans with the anesthetists and to demonstrate to the radiologists just what orthopedic rentgenograms were and what they meant, but to train orderlies and nurses on how to put on braces and use various appliances in connection with orthopedic work. And we didn't have specialist orthopedic nurses as we had in New York. So that this was a very pioneering type of period, but a very exciting one, having been spoon-fed in New York to start all over in a sort of a pioneer atmosphere. The work grew and developed and had other phases. Not only was this a form of teaching, but also the whole staff was unaware of really what orthopedics was and what it could do. At first there had been some resistance for fear that I would take away, as they expressed it, the bread from their mouths, but I soon assured them that I was interested in doing what they had not been doing and not taking away what they were doing, particularly if they were doing it well. The general surgeons, for example, were doing the fracture work and doing it reasonably well, although hadn't gotten involved with open fracture surgery. We had no interns, and my assistants in the operating room were usually the general practitioners who referred the patients, which helped them to find out what orthopedics was all about. But sometimes this was difficult because in the midst of an operation they might suddenly remember that they had an appointment and have to leave, and this wasn't always fortuitous. We had no interns in those days and no teaching program, but the staff itself was interested, so with the slides which I had from New York and from the material from my book, I was able to develop a teaching program for orthopedics, first for the surgical staff and then for the medical staff, and this became the nucleus of a teaching program subsequently when we began to get interns and residents, not in orthopedics but for medicine and for surgery. And so actually this was the initiation of the teaching program in the Greenwich Hospital. In the meantime, of course, groups like the Pediatric Society were interested in orthopedics, which seemed to be coming to Connecticut, and I was invited on their programs to teach them the diagnosis of displaced hips and slipped epiphysis and so forth, which was very fine because this made it possible for early diagnosis and early treatment, which I considered essential and I considered to be modern orthopedics at that time. I was also invited to the state societies and continued in the national societies. And with the new material in Greenwich, as well as the basic material I had in New York, I was able to continue writing and to develop many new papers, including the material from all of these sources. In 1951, I was invited to attend the big international meeting called SICOT, or Society International for Orthopedics and Traumatology. This was held in Stockholm, Sweden, and this was the beginning of my international orthopedic activities, although I was not on that program. While there, I met a number of orthopedists, including Gunnar Wiberg from from Sweden, and Robert Joudet from Paris, who then was very much in the limelight because of his hip prosthesis operation. And I did go and spend a week with him, seeing his operation, and subsequently come back and introduce it at our hospital at Greenwich. In the meantime, I talked with those two men regarding the possibility of organizing an international small group of orthopedists so that we could really take up where the other meetings left off. And although this took some time to develop, and perhaps we'll refer to it again later, this was its beginning in the beginning of my international career. So the teaching in those days had many phases. I found the teaching of medical students to be interesting, but that the medical students themselves were really not very concerned, because most of them were not really going into orthopedics. And in that sense, the undergraduate teaching was relatively unrewarding. I was given the teaching of the undergraduate nurses at the Greenwich Hospital, and we also did have sessions for the graduate nurses, because they too had not been trained in orthopedics. And so we had a rather broad teaching program, locally as well as generally. All of this led to writing, and it's been my custom for many years to write two papers, one for oral presentation and one for publication, because there are differences, not only in time and content, but also in manner of presentation between oral and written, and I found this a very good approach to these various articles.
How did orthopedics develop in your part of Connecticut?
On coming to Connecticut, naturally, with my exposure to joint tuberculosis and polio and so forth in Connecticut, I was thinking in New York, I was thinking in these terms, and suspected every swollen joint of being tuberculosis. Actually, none of them were. I never found a single fresh case of joint tuberculosis in 25 years in Connecticut. And polio rapidly disappeared, because Greenwich was one of the first towns in which the vaccine was used. So we ceased getting early cases, but still had some residual cases. So that instead of the greater volume of practice being related to these two problems, and also to scoliosis, which was uncommon in our part of Connecticut, the nature of the practice was entirely different. The most common problem was low backache, and with it often associated sciatica. There were many sports injuries, as the people in the Greenwich area were sports-minded. These were not the big injuries such as occur in professional football, but we did have torn knee cartilages, we did have a great many skiing injuries, and with the highways nearby, and speeds much greater than in New York City, we had more serious automobile injuries, and occasionally motorcycle injuries. So that the nature of practice in Greenwich became quite different from the nature of practice in New York. And so between the development program, the nature of the orthopedic practice itself, the radical change in the teaching program, particularly in relation to the audiences to which it was directed, the whole situation in Connecticut for me was quite different, and my wife and I called it our second career. The international part of our activities developed considerably, so that usually each year we made one or two trips to some foreign country, centered around some meeting, and I became involved with a number of international associations, so that generally there were one or two meetings which involved me each year. These would be used as a focal point for other activities in orthopedics, such as being visiting professor or giving lectures, and occasionally even operating in other countries. And so the international aspect of my teaching developed considerably. Not only did I teach, but also I learned. I found always that it's possible to learn from everyone, from every situation, and in every country. And although sometimes other countries are called backward in some ways, I found that in orthopedics, there were always men in each country who were very forward looking and very forward acting in the practice of orthopedics, and there was always something that I could learn. And so it was a two-way street and a fair exchange, when I was able to help them, and they were able to pass on some of their knowledge to me. This, I think, is essential in today's world, so that we must first have communication, second, understanding, and third, an interchange of ideas and of practices in order to, for all of us in medicine, which is one of the great joys of medicine, to remain way out in front.
Were you concerned with medical and orthopedic meetings?
Yes, and not only meetings, but the various societies. In the course of these activities, I was invited to become a member of the Canadian Orthopedic Association after being the guest speaker for the president one year, and subsequently, in a similar manner, a member of the Japanese Orthopedic Association. Because of my contributions in other countries, I was made an honorary member of the Societies of Orthopedics and Traumatology in Guatemala, in Chile, in Turkey, and of the Latin American Association of Orthopedics and Traumatology, and the South African Orthopedic Association, as well as the more local Louisiana Orthopedic Association and the New England Orthopedic Association. In addition, a member of the International Orthopedic Society, which I mentioned, the Pan-Pacific Surgical Association, of which I was orthopedic vice president for one term, and the corresponding member of the New Zealand Orthopedic Association. I don't like to be a member of anything unless I am active and participating, and in all of these organizations I have had and continue to have an active part.
What are your medical society connections?
I mentioned the foreign and honorary memberships. I'm, of course, a member of the American Medical Association, American College of Surgeons, American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, and the American Orthopedic Association, of which I was vice president in 1962 and president in 1963. A member of the Association of Bone and Joint Surgeons, which has been the founder and sponsor of the orthopedic journal Clinical Orthopedics. I have been a member of the Interurban Orthopedic Club, which was the first orthopedic club, I believe, in the world, founded in 1907, since the early 30s, and for the past 35 years have been secretary of that club, which unintentionally apparently is some sort of record. I've long been a member of the Orthopedic Research Society, and we have several correspondence clubs, and I'm a member of two of these. The first one was called the Orthopedic Correspondence Club, founded by Earl McBride of Oklahoma City. The idea was that there would be 52 members, and that each one would be assigned a week, and during his week write a letter to the other 51 members. The early members were all or nearly all Americans, and it operated in that fashion for a good many years, and I became one of its relatively early members. Another group called the Spectators, founded in this, on the same plan, has subsequently become more interested in having foreign members, although the Correspondence Club has quite a number now, and I have been able to help in adding foreign membership because of my connections in other countries, so that the Spectators Club now is about equally divided between foreign and American members, about 50 of each. And this means that first we exchange ideas in orthopedics, often material which has not yet reached publication. Second, of course, we exchange friendships, and this has been an important aspect of these clubs. And Third, we can exchange information along any lines which we choose, such as our personal lives, our travels, our thoughts, our philosophy, and so forth. This has side benefits in that not only has this been very effective in these ways, but also we try to have at least once a year at some meeting a luncheon or a dinner so that particularly the foreign and American members can get together. But there are other benefits too. For example, I was going to Egypt and only to Cairo on one of my trips, which involved a number of countries. And I wrote to a member of the Correspondence Club and said that I was coming to Cairo and asked if there were anything that I might do for their orthopedic association. He lived in Alexandria, which is some distance from Cairo, and he replied that he had arranged for me to give a lecture to the Cairo Orthopedic Association and that everything would be in order. When my wife and I checked into the hotel in Cairo, we had no idea of seeing anyone that we knew. But a half hour later, the phone rang. We were told that this doctor was downstairs in the lobby waiting for us. He had driven 150 miles to come to Cairo from Alexandria to welcome us. And I said, why did you do this? It's taken your time and effort, and it wasn't really that important. He said, well, I've known you for 10 years. I have a copy of your book, and I studied it from cover to cover, as well as being a mutual member of the Correspondence Club. This has happened on a number of occasions in various ways, and it's been one of the joys, as well as the benefits of such international contacts, so that we have felt that all of these things were not only personally worthwhile, but helpful in developing orthopedics around the world, as well as developing, in a sense, international understanding and goodwill.
Tell me more about this international society that you founded.
We decided, as with our Inter-Urban Orthopedic Club, to limit it to 25 members so that we really could get close together in our exchange of ideas and in our friendships. This did not include those who might subsequently pass the age of 65 and thus become senior members, so that they were not counted in the group. It took us a little while to get started, but we had our first meeting in 1960 in Greenwich, Connecticut, with 10 charter members and proposals for additional members. At the next meeting in Oxford, England, and at Ridington with Charney, who's the one who's done so much in developing the total hip prosthesis operation, we just about filled our full complement of 25 members. Our qualifications for membership were, first, that one must be a distinguished orthopedist in his own country. Second, that he must be able to communicate in English, because we weren't able to set up a translation system. And third, that he be willing and able to regularly attend the meetings. Our club has been very successful, and we now are in our 15th year. At our last meetings, we met in Geneva, Switzerland, and in Munich, Germany. And at our coming meeting in July of this year, we will meet in Paris and in Rotterdam. This will just about complete a circuit of all of the countries and cities represented in our group. We do have a member from Hong Kong who has long been internationally distinguished in orthopedics. We do have a member from South Africa, and now two members, including a senior member from South America. So that aside from Australia, all continents are represented. Australia is considered it too far to come for this meeting, and we can understand. We have limited the number of members from the United States to 4, Canada and Britain to 3, and the other countries 1, 2, or 3, so that we would have a good distribution in this total membership. This has proven a very great success in that we've had excellent meetings, we have fine friendships, and we've had a really wonderful exchange of ideas at our various for the context.
What was the, or is the official name of this society?
The National Orthopedic Society.
Can you summarize your work for us?
Well, as mentioned, my work has consisted of the three important phases of medicine, or those that I consider important: patient care, investigation, and teaching and writing. And these I have pursued all of these 48 years since I've been in orthopedics, plus the 2 years that I started my training in surgery. It has been possible because I have been in control of my schedule since moving to Connecticut to be available for these various meetings and trips in other countries. And I have thought that, for me at least, this was better than being too involved with one institution and with administrative work. During this time, I've written the three books: the textbook of orthopedics, a subsequent one called Examination in Orthopedic, Examination of the Spinal Extremities, and a third one called Injuries of the Spine. For the latter, I needed material on the neurosurgical aspects of orthopedics, and I had trained and worked with Dr. William Coon, who subsequently, with Penfield, went to the Montreal Neurological Institute. And after his death, Dr. Gordon Petrie, who was the orthopedist who had worked with Coon, was able to obtain for me quite adequate material for that portion of the book on injuries of the spine. Altogether, there have been some 65 papers on orthopedics, a dozen or so for consumers research, several for medicine journals, and several for the mountaineering journals. In addition, there have been many talks, some of which have not yet been published, some of which would not be published, and my activities with such groups as the Rotary Club. My special interests have been, as mentioned, congenital displacement of the hip, slipping of the capital femoral epiphysis, dynamic posture, which has really been well developed and is pretty much unique, and especially low back problems in more recent years, and skiing injuries, as well as some other aspects of trauma. These, I think, I've been able to make contributions which certainly have been worthwhile. My most recent activity was in Los Angeles, where I was asked to initiate the new chair of orthopedic surgery at the University of Southern California in the Orthopedic Hospital, and I've just come from that meeting 2 days ago. This then is a summary of his various orthopedic activities.
What were your other interests and activities, for example, with the Rotary Club?
One is a member of his local Rotary Club, but of course Rotary is international, and I participated in various programs and on the program committee of our club in Greenwich. Until about 6 years ago, they asked me to become chairman of the World Community Service Committee. And I asked what they would like me to do, and they said, "We'd like you to do something because this committee has not been active." I thought about various possibilities and recall that at the Mission Hospital in Kathmandu, Nepal, there was a considerable problem with nurses because all of their nurses had been brought in from other countries at considerable expense, and naturally they didn't speak the language and they weren't familiar with the customs of the people. A nursing training school had just been started with considerable difficulty in recruiting nurses who were sufficiently well educated to be able to take the course. Our club decided to subsidize the education of 5 nurses of a class of 9. My wife and I had one of these as our special nurse, and the club subsidized the other 4. This group graduated 2 years ago, and we're very proud of them, and they've become very effective in the nursing care in their country. We started with a new group then and are now beginning the 3rd year with the 2nd group. This was sufficiently unusual to have been, without our competing, awarded the district prize of the Rotary Group. And we're very proud of this achievement in our firm. In addition, I've been asked to speak to many groups on many subjects, such as our local historical societies, our church groups, geriatrics or retired persons groups, sometimes young groups such as the Boy Scouts, and this has involved a variety of subjects. Altogether in the Rotary Club, I've been for our local group on 20 different programs, as well as programs in many other places such as Jackson, Wyoming, and Aspen, Colorado, and Bermuda, and even in foreign countries.
Could you tell us of your whitewater canoeing?
Yes, this simply means being able to carry the canoe safely down through the rapids. There should be enough water in the stream to float the canoe between the rocks. Once, I remember, we went in relatively low water and the canoe got stuck on two rocks and broke into pieces. We use either an ordinary canoe or a fault boat. A fault boat is a folding boat which can be taken apart and easily carried inside a car and stored under a bed. And my wife and I were able to assemble our boat in about 15 minutes. And we usually make a 15 or 20 mile trip downriver in one day. And actually, we paddle backwards when we come to the critical places in the rapids, because if one is going slower than the stream, the chance of disaster is much less, and the control of the canoe or a foreboat is much better than if one is going faster than the stream. This is a very pleasant and exciting sport, and quite different from mountaineering and skiing.
Have you continued to ski?
Yes, I've been a member of the Rocky Mountain Society of Traumatology since the second year of its formation, at which time I was asked to come out and give a paper by one of the founders of the group, and I was then put on the program committee, and they've given many papers for them at various times. So in connection with that, I, as well as the other members of the group, have been skiing in Colorado. I had previously been skiing in New England for many years, as mentioned before, when I learned to ski. And this was very nice in a way, because in Colorado we could depend much better on the weather and on the trail conditions. And instead of taking a quick weekend trip up to New England, it seemed much better to concentrate our skiing in 2 or 3 weeks. We have skied in other places in Colorado, such as Arapaho, and in other places in this country, such as Sun Valley, Idaho, and at Alton near Salt Lake City. And we've had 2 trips to the French Alps and to the Swiss Alps, or 3 to the Swiss, on skis, which were very exciting, not only because of the skiing, but because if we wished, and as we did, one can ski up on the glaciers. But of course, this is a different technique, because it's necessary to keep under complete control in order to avoid falling into crevasses. At one time, a guide and I did climb the Wentz Glacier between the Monte Rosa and the Liscombe, 2 of the highest peaks in the Alps, to an altitude above 14,000 feet. This was about 5 horizontal miles and about 6,000 or 7,000 vertical feet on skis with no lifts. And then we skied down together, roped and under control, the whole length of the glacier. Perhaps this might be called our most exciting excursion on skis.
Have you continued to climb mountains?
Yes, haven't always been able to do it as often as we would like, because we've been too involved with meetings and can only afford so much time and expense. Last year, for example, we had 11 meetings and I was on 12 programs, so we didn't do any climbing. And in the previous year, we had the third trip to South Africa, and that too prevented our climbing. But the previous year, we went to Switzerland and Austria and spent 3 weeks there on a pure vacation with no orthopedics. One day we took a bus trip to see the country, but the other 20 days I was climbing or conditioning in the mountains, and this meant altogether in 20 days about 150 miles of up and down walking at altitudes up to 10,000 feet, in addition to a vertical ascent and descent of 3 to 4,000 feet each day. This is a sample of the kind of thing that we have done many, many summers, sometimes in Wyoming, sometimes in the Alps, and this includes not only the Swiss Alps, but the French, the Italian, and the Austrian Alps, the four major alpine countries. At one time I was invited to participate in the meeting of the Winter Sports Association of the five alpine countries, their languages being French, German, and Italian, I being the only one who normally spoke English, although many of them could speak and understand it. So I gave my paper in French. That was the only time that I've given a paper in a foreign language, but it was an interesting experience. So that we have and tend to continue skiing and mountaineering. The four questions I'm commonly asked: are you still in practice? Do you still ski? Do you still climb? And do you still travel? And the answer to all four questions is yes.
What are your community activities?
Well, we mentioned the Rotary Club activities, and in addition to that, I think I've fairly well covered the fact that I do talk to various groups. One of the last talks I gave was to a high school group on selection career, and in special reference to medicine. I know of no generation gap. I think gaps between people are produced by people, and there are all kinds of gaps if people are looking for them, and there are ways of bridging these gaps. Likewise, in traveling in foreign countries, I don't consider that we have a language barrier. It is true that Americans and British people tend to expect everyone else to talk their language rather than to bother to learn the language of some other country. I find that if one learns even a few words of the language of a foreign country, this immediately makes people more friendly. And I think of language not as a barrier, but as a bridge. And if we don't cross the bridge, it's our fault. It's not the fault of the language. So my community activities are related not only to the community in which we live, but we consider ourselves part of a world community. And consider our relationships with our friends and contacts in other countries as also community activities.
Could you tell us something more about your travels?
Since 1951, most of our travels have been centered around meetings. Before that, we often made skiing trips and mountaineering trips which had no connection with meetings. Usually with a meeting as a focal point, there are several other connecting meetings. For example, when we had a meeting of the Western Pacific Orthopedic Association in Hong Kong, there were subsidiary meetings in Malaysia and Singapore. And I had been asked to let certain friends know whenever I came their way. So we started that trip by having a meeting in Anchorage, Alaska. We continued with a meeting in Taipei, Taiwan, and following a meeting in Sapporo, Japan, with our Japanese friends. And then the big meeting in Hong Kong, the subsidiary meetings in Malaysia and Singapore, which meant a total of six meetings in that one trip. This is representative. This we've done on quite a number of occasions. Another time we started with a meeting in Montreal and continued with a series of meetings in Britain of the American Fracture Association, then went down to Uganda where I served as visiting professor for some days, and from there to South Africa. So that too turned out to be a string of meetings. When we met in Australia and New Zealand, often that's been connected directly or indirectly with the meeting in Hawaii or in some other place along the way. Now, we have many interests, and we relate our travels to the situation in the various countries. For instance, we made a trip to Greece. This was made on a boat, stopping at various ports, and there was a faculty from Oxford and Cambridge which lectured on the art, archaeology, sculpture, history of ancient Greece. And we attended the lectures in the morning and made field trips in the afternoon, and of course took pictures as we went along the way. So that my slide collection includes many photographs of the great ancient things of Greece, and our experience is related to the particular things of interest there. Same thing applied when we went to Egypt. But when we go to East Africa, of course our interests become those of that country. And in New Zealand, for example, we were interested in the Maori people, who were the people who were there when Captain Cook arrived. And we have subsequently been somewhat largely integrated into the British population on the islands. If we go to Australia, we are interested in the Aborigines, to the North Island of Japan, to the Hari Ainus. And in many countries, to the geography, the geology, the architecture, the archaeology, the way of life, even the dress and the food and the art of people like the Japanese, whose whole traditions and society are in many ways different from ours, and yet basically they're people like ourselves, and we find them to have many common characteristics, and incidentally to be not only very fine people but very fine hosts.
Is there anything else you would like to add to this oral history interview?
It's been a privilege to record this, and I hope that it will be of interest and use to others. We have had, my wife and I, a very interesting and fascinating and exciting life with a variety of facets to it, our professional life, our international life, our community life, and this has all been a great joy and interest. We feel that we have been especially fortunate in being able to do all of these things and to relate to them and to participate in them instead of just wandering through as a tourist, for example, and really not comprehending very much of what it's all about. This approach to travel can be a great help in learning what the rest of the world is doing, why it's doing it, how it's doing it. We never like to go to a country and say we know how to do it better than you do. Often, in some ways, other people know how to do things better than we do. And our way of life is not necessarily their best way of life. Our intense industrialization and commercialism actually has destroyed many values in our country. And I don't think that all the other countries in the world should try to be like us. I am distressed at times when I find that in some countries the things which they imitate are the things which I would consider the bad characteristics, such as drug involvement, such as the girls dressing in high heels in the middle of the day instead of wearing their comfortable, nice shoes, such as people changing their dress from that beautiful feminine wear to some of our rather horrible looking feminine clothes, and certainly in neatness and in posture we find much to be envied in the conduct of people in other countries as compared sometimes with our own. I think, however, that in our country there's now that we have deteriorated in many ways, there is a great opportunity for a renaissance, and I trust that this will come. And certainly those of us who feel that way can assist in each in our small way in seeing that this does come. I encourage other people to retain their great traditions and their great art and other things which have come down to them, rather than to try to change this and make it all American. On the other hand, there are things that we can contribute to other countries and which we have contributed. And for a long time we drew from Europe, but in the past decade or two it's been our privilege and opportunity to pass on, particularly in orthopedics, some of the things that have been developed as well as originated in our country. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you for participating in this interview, Dr. Howarth. This concludes oral history interview number 16.